February 4th, 2008, Wellington, New Zealand, chapters 13 to 18 of Bhagavad Gita.
Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Oravani Pacharani Nivase Sasimani Vaskatyadi Sutani Mandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Sucha Shri Rupam Sagrijatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajiva Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ravita Shri Vishatam Vitamstha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Okay. What happens in the first chapter?
Setting the scene,
yes, what happens? Okay, what's the main thing that happens in the first chapter? Good, thank you. Comes Krishna's disciple in the second chapter, beginning of the second chapter. What are his four arguments in the first chapter?
Compassion,
sinful reactions,
destruction
of family, and
enjoyment.
Now you won't get any enjoyment. So then second chapter, you said he becomes Krishna's disciple. What else happens in the second chapter? Matter and spirit, to answer Arjuna's question about compassion. Compassion, answers Arjuna's question about compassion. How does Krishna answer Arjuna's question about enjoyment? He'll enjoy if he did his duty. He talks about materially, you'll enjoy if you do your duty. And spiritually, he says you'll enjoy if you? As a? Sacrifice, as a sacrifice. So on material level, he's saying that you'll enjoy if you'll do your duty instead of running away from your duty. And spiritually, you enjoy if you do your duty as a sacrifice. How does he answer the question of sin? It's sinful if you don't do your duty. He answers the question of family destruction in the third chapter. Okay. And then he says that he explains the difference between material and spiritual duties, which are a matter of
consciousness.
Yes, and he explains it like the difference between very good. Okay. Third chapter, Krishna is talking about mostly what? Which topic from the second chapter does he really get into in chapter 3? He's talking about that a little bit. Mostly he's talking about how to do your duty as a sacrifice. It's mostly about how to do your duty as a sacrifice, why you should do your duty as a sacrifice. And there Krishna answers the question of family destruction by saying what? Yes, that's what breaks up families. And Krishna says even he works in that way. Right? And he ends with saying, to do work in sacrifice, you need to do your work with?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. Okay, then the fourth chapter is all about knowledge. What is that knowledge? And what does Krishna start off the fourth chapter with?
Explaining himself.
Explaining why he's in authority on what he's talking about. This is very, very, very important, by the way, to all of us as preachers. Please, never preach and apologize. Please don't ever do that.
Please don't ever get up to preach and say, I'm really sorry, I'm not qualified to tell you this. Okay, if you're not qualified, then what should you do? Yeah, and in the meantime, what should you do? Be quiet. If you're actually not qualified, you can be quiet and become qualified. So please don't ever get up and say, there's one time when you can get up and apologize, and that is if everyone expected somebody else to be there. You know, or if you're late or something like that. You know, if you advertise for Dave Amrita Maharaj to come, and his plane got delayed, and you're there instead, then you certainly should apologize. Say, I'm really sorry, you were all expecting somebody a lot more qualified than myself, and I'm just filling in, and I hope you'll excuse me. But otherwise, I don't apologize. Actually, you should establish why you're qualified. Okay? So Krishna established why he's qualified. He established the history of the knowledge, and then what does he say in chapter 4? He's describing different kinds of sacrifices, different kinds of sacrifice, and he says to know the way that you should sacrifice, you should approach a spiritual master. Okay, then we go on to chapter 5, where now Krishna's taking what he explained in chapter 3 and chapter 4 and putting them together. He's basically repeating a lot of the themes of chapter 3, but in a deeper way. And he's saying, what is this knowledge? So if you're working, if you're sacrificing with knowledge, what's the first kind of knowledge that you have? He's going back to repeat some of the ideas of chapter 2 and bringing them all together. You know that when you're working, when you're doing things, you're not the control. You're not really doing anything at all. And another aspect of having higher consciousness is you see equality. You see equality. You don't think in terms of friends and enemies. Wasn't that a lot of the problem in battlefield, friends and enemies, right? He's saying, does Krishna talk a lot about equal vision in the Bhagavad Gita? Interesting. You have a fight with your enemies, but you don't see them as your enemies. Interesting. So that's one way you fight, as a sacrifice. And being detached from material things. And where are you getting your pleasure? Within. From within. You're getting your pleasure from within. How can you be detached if you're looking for your pleasure outside? And how do you have peace? Knowing that he's the proprietor and joy. Remember earlier Krishna said you can't have any happiness without peace. Now he's telling you how to get peace. And he ends the fifth chapter with saying that the way to achieve this is through doing what? Well, yeah. Yeah, right before that. The verses right before that. He says, the way that you achieve this knowledge and this detachment and this equal vision and all that, you have to do what?
Practice bhakti yoga.
He doesn't say bhakti yoga.
Work for me? Is it like work and
kama
yoga?
No, he's talking about, what's the sixth chapter about? You guys have to know what the sixth chapter about if you're running a yoga center. Jnana yoga. All right, well, that starts in the fifth chapter. Second to last verse in the fifth chapter, Krishna introduces jnana yoga. Because you might say, okay, great, you know, I want to work thinking I'm not the doer, I want to work with equal vision, I want to work with detachment, well, how do I do that? And Krishna's saying, perform jnana yoga. Oh, by the way, this is like somebody asked me in Chaupati in Mumbai years ago, how do I think of Krishna while I work? And I said, start by thinking of Krishna when you're chanting. So, it's although we're not performing the exact process of jnana yoga that Krishna gives in the sixth chapter, we're doing the essence of it. That's the whole idea of having our morning program. Spending time reading during the day. Then whatever you can do as a sacrifice. Otherwise, trying to do things as a sacrifice is pretty hard, isn't it? Right? I mean, why would Krishna speak the sixth chapter if he wanted Arjuna to stay on the battlefield? Sounds like he wants him to go to the Himalayas or something. Doesn't that seem kind of odd? Have you ever thought that was kind of odd? So just like we say to our members, you know, go out and fight with Maya. Go out and fight Kali Yuga. Be part of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's army. But every day you sit down and you meditate, don't you? I hope you do. Okay. And then, of course, after Krishna describes that particular system of meditation, Arjuna says, what? It's too hard. And what will happen if I fail? What will happen if I fail? By the way, when you're preaching,
Please notice that those questions will be asked over and over again in different forms by almost everybody. That I think this process is too hard, and what will happen if I fail? And those are very common questions. They don't always come quite in those words. And then Krishna, of course, assures him that there's always success, even for a little bit of yoga, and his destination will be good. All right. Now Krishna has talked about doing work as a sacrifice by focusing your mind on him, on Krishna, right? That's what he's talked about all along, and especially emphasized, of course, in the sixth chapter, which is all about controlling the mind and fixing the mind on him. So then, I guess you want to know something about him. How am I going to fix the mind on him without knowing something about him? And this is a big advantage that we have as followers of the Vedas, and specifically as followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and even more specifically as followers of Srila Prabhupada, that we really know something about God. I mean, most religious systems in the world, even most people who claim to be following the Vedas, don't know a whole lot about God, isn't it? You that were brought up in India, wouldn't you say? It's kind of a mishmash in India now, isn't it? You know, we tend to think people brought up in India, they know, but often they don't know. Would you agree? Were you brought up in India?
No.
So that's what I find. I find even people brought up, you know, in Hindu families or even in Vaishnava families, they'll often say, I didn't understand my own tradition until I came in touch with Srila Prabhupada's books. So here Krishna is telling us about himself, and what does he say in the seventh chapter about himself? Yeah? So for all those descriptions, they have something in common, that Krishna is the what of everything? The essence of everything or the origin of everything. The essence or the origin of everything. And then you might say, well, then why doesn't everybody know this? And he says, because they're covered. They're covered, so they don't surrender. Is there a third category between people who do and don't surrender? Yeah, he's not discussing that here, though. He gives four classes of people who surrender and four classes of people who don't surrender. And then he talks about two other groups of people. Good. Demigod worshippers and the worshippers of the?
Brahman.
Yes. Okay. So it's not just one or the other. And that's going to come out in the next six chapters as well. And then Arjuna asks a bunch of questions, which Krishna answers. And the main thing that he focuses on in the eighth chapter is how you can attain him. When? At the time of death. It's mostly about how one remembers Krishna at the time of death. And Krishna talks about what is the destination. He compares the spiritual world to the material world. What does remembering him mean? What is going to him mean? So at the end of the eighth chapter, Krishna is describing how miserable the material world is and the difference between that and his abode. Then, ninth chapter, he goes back. He kind of repeats the seventh chapter, but in a little bit more depth. He talks about himself again, yeah, and he talks about Achintya Beta Beta Tattva, how he's everywhere but not everywhere. And Krishna talks about people who know him as the origin serve him, the great Mahatmas serve him. And then again he says, other people, they worship the demigods or the impersonal Brahman. And there he starts talking about how the devotees are superior. He says, even if the devotees are fallen, still they're saintly. And not only are the devotees superior, but my process is superior, he's saying, because all you need to do to worship me is offer a little leaf of water, fruit or water. Such a simple process. And keep in mind the last verse of the ninth chapter, because we're going to talk about that today. The last verse of the ninth chapter, Krishna says, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto. Yes. Always think of me, become my devotee. All right, tenth chapter. Tenth chapter, Arjuna says, his illusion is destroyed. Right? And then we have the four key verses of the Bhagavad Gita are in the 10th chapter. 8, 9, 10, and 11. Where Krishna says, I'm the source of everything. People find great happiness and bliss from talking about me, and then I reciprocate with them. So that's bhakti, the bhakta, bhakti, and Bhagavan. Right? It's the essence of everything in those four verses. If you want to memorize only four verses in the whole Bhagavad Gita, memorize those four verses. They're the four what we call nutshell verses. And then Arjuna asks to hear about how Krishna is in the world. Right? There's also verses in the ninth chapter where Krishna talks about how you can understand him in the world on the butter, the fire, the offering. So 7, 9, and then 10. In 10, Krishna describes himself not as the essence of everything, but as the what of everything? As the what of everything. No, that was 7th. 7th is origin and essence. 10th is? The best of everything. Oh, he's the best of everything. The most powerful, the strongest, the most beautiful, whatever. He had all different categories. And if you want to think about Krishna, you think about the best of anything, and that represents Krishna. And then Arjuna, after hearing that, he says, okay, I've heard how you're in the world. Now I want to see you as the world. I've heard how you're in the world. I want to see you as the world. And there's two different universal forms, actually, that are shown. And the first one is where Krishna is showing that all things exist in him, all space in one place. All space in one place. And all time at one time. All space in one place, all time at one time. Everything there. And then the universal form changes to that of? That's at the end. Universal form changes to? That's at the end. Yes, changes to time and death. The universal form changes to time and death, and specifically shows Arjuna things about the battlefield. You know, if he was showing it to some of us, he'd show us things that were interesting to us. And to Arjuna, he showed something that was interesting to him. And at the end, as you said, he shows his forearm form, and then his two-arm form. And then he says something at the end. He says, you can only know me through devotion, not through what else? Not through? Not through? Fruit of activities, not through? Austerities, not through worship. And then Prabhupada has this purport saying, you can do all those things in bhakti to know him. You can do austerities in bhakti, you can do worship in bhakti, you can gather knowledge in bhakti to know him. And I did recommend that you take a look at those verses and chapters at the end of the, verses and purports at the end of the 11th chapter. Okay, then what's Arjuna's question beginning of the 12th chapter? Impersonal or personal? Because Krishna's talked twice about the impersonal, remember, in 7th and 9th chapter? Some people worship me, some people don't, and some people worship the demigods, and some people worship the impersonal. And Krishna's already pretty much condemned the demigod worshippers in those chapters, but he hasn't so much condemned the impersonalists in those chapters. So then Arjuna says, well, what's better? You know, you've made it pretty clear that those who don't surrender to you at all are not very good. You've made it pretty clear that those who worship the demigods are not in a good position. What about the impersonalists? And then Krishna says, the impersonalists have two problems. What's their two problems? They have a hard time doing what? Becoming? Yeah, they have a hard time becoming liberated because you have to, Prabhupada says you have to stop all the non-perceptual feelings. I haven't the foggiest notion of what that means. So you have a very hard time becoming liberated because you have to do something that's artificial and unnatural. You have to stop thinking. You have to stop feeling. You have to stop desiring. You have to stop acting. You have to stop everything. You have to become practically nothing. So it's very hard to do it. And then what's the other problem? Once you do it, it's very hard to? To stay there because you don't want to? Surrender to Krishna. You think Krishna is also Maya. Right? And then Krishna tells us about, and this part of the 12th chapter is so important, both for our own Krishna consciousness and for preaching to others and for having a Krishna conscious society, where Krishna gives the different types of people that are part of a spiritual society. The first one is people who always think of him. The second are people who perform sadhana bhakti. What's the purpose of sadhana bhakti? What? Icha! Oh, great, give her a hand. Very good. All right. The purpose of sadhana bhakti is to get icha. Icha means?
Desire.
My dear devotees, if you're doing abhyasa yoga, sadhana bhakti, and you're not developing an increased desire to love Krishna, to think about Krishna, there's something wrong. And Prabhupada says if you're eating and you're still hungry after you're eating and eating and eating and eating and eating, then there's two things going on, two possibilities. What's one possibility? You're eating and eating and eating and eating and eating and you're still not full.
You're not conscious of what you're eating.
That could be. You're really spaced out. You're like eating in a coma. Well, he doesn't give that as a possibility, but I guess that is a possibility. You're sort of in a coma. Sometimes very overweight people are like that. They're not even aware of what they're eating. They're just eating all the time. He says one is that you're not really eating. How could you be eating but not really eating? That's pretty, really easy in modern society. Chewing gum. Mm-hmm. Right? Chewing gum. Or you're eating this food without calories. Just for the taste of it. Right? They used to advertise Diet Coke like that. Just for the taste of it. No calories, no nutrition, no benefit. Right? Looks like food, but it's not food. So one thing is you're not really eating. And the other possibility is you got parasites. You got parasites. So not really eating means you're not following the process or you're following some bogus process, and parasites means you're doing what? Yes, you're committing offenses. You're committing offenses, especially against Vaishnavas. Okay, so we should, the first thing is always think of me. Second thing, if you're not always going to think of me, then engage in not yet work. Sadhana. And the purpose of sadhana bhakti is to develop icha, desire. Desire. Please keep that focus every day, every moment that you're engaged in sadhana bhakti, that the purpose of sadhana bhakti is to develop a desire. Once you develop that strong desire, are you any more in sadhana bhakti? No. No. Then you're in raganuga bhakti. Okay. And the next thing, if you're not able, willing to do that, either think of Krishna or do abhyasa yoga, then what's the next alternative? Work for me. So those three classes of people are our main members in the Hare Krishna movement, people in those three categories. And then if you can't even do that, you can cultivate knowledge, you can give away your possessions. And Krishna ends the 12th chapter by listing what? The qualities of his devotees. He's listing the qualities of his devotees. Okay. And that's important because remember when we talked about having a well-formed plan, we talked about we have to know what are the behaviors, thoughts, and feelings that we want to achieve. So Krishna is very, very specific about what are the behaviors, thoughts, and feelings of a transcendentalist. He was talked about in the second chapter where Arjuna asked for it. He talks about the end of the 12th chapter, and the question will be asked again in the chapters we're going over today. Okay? Ready now? Now, we're not going to be able to review what I'm going over today. So what am I going to suggest that you guys do after I go? I know, my dear lady, you give yourselves a test, because I won't be here to give you a test. So my suggestion is that after what we go over today, because I won't have time to review the whole thing, does it help to review?
Yes.
Yes, it helps to review. Krishna reviews. Right? The 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is a review of the whole Bhagavad Gita. Plus, there's a little bit more information, but it's a review of the whole Bhagavad Gita. Review is important. And we're going to look at three places in the 18th chapter that are repeats of something, almost word for word, repeats of something early in the chapter. Review is a very powerful teaching tool. Are you all supposed to be teachers and preachers? Yes, Ramila, we are all supposed to be teachers and preachers. So we want to learn how to be good teachers and preachers from the best teacher and preacher, who's God. Right? So please review. You will learn much better if you do that. It will stick much more. And you can do it any way you like. Do it on your own. Better to do it with a partner or in a group of three or four. And best to do it within about 24 hours. So my suggestion is that sometime in the next 24 hours, you get together with somebody. You can read over this paper that you all got, which is a summary of the Bhagavad Gita, and then ask each other questions. What's in this chapter? What's in this chapter? How do the chapters fit together? And especially look at these last six chapters. And my other suggestion, as I gave you before, is that you read through these six chapters, if you haven't done it in preparation for today, that you do it as soon as possible after this class. And if you don't have time to read everything with the purports, at least go through and read the verses. And, you know, read whatever you might. What I find if I do that is I always end up reading parts of some purports. And that way this stuff will stick. Okay? Doing that stuff makes it stick. We like things to stick?
Yeah.
Yes, we would like things to stick. So that's one of the ways to make things stick. That's true in general, by the way, that if ever you hear a class or you you know, listen to a class on a tape, or you listen to a class in person, or you read something, one of the best ways to make it stick is to
tell somebody.
You know, and if there's no one around to tell, write it in a diary or something, you know, something where you're hearing and chanting. All right, we went through that rather quickly, and I'm going to try to finish this by 8:30 to facilitate all of your work, so I am speaking a little fast, but review is important. How does Arjuna start off the 13th chapter? He says, please tell me now about matter, because Krishna has described in detail the jiva, the work of the jiva, and God. Oh, but a lot of people have to leave. How many people have to leave?
I went already.
Oh, you already worked?
No, I went at 7. I cannot stop. So it's okay, you can go.
Okay.
I don't know about you.
How many people here have to leave at 8:30? One? Any more? You have to leave at 8:30. Two people have to leave at 8:30. So I think what I'll do is I'll go through, I'll do a summary. I can finish a summary by 8:30. And then we'll spend some time looking at some details after that, and we'll take questions after that. So I'm sorry, you get to miss the questions.
I want Steve.
Okay, well, if you want. if you want, just don't lose your job. Remember that it has to be in harmony with your life, right? So, all right.
They take so many breaks for coffee and stuff like
that. Ah, they do, don't they? Yeah, well, materially, the workers try to work as just the bare minimum that they have to work to get their money.
Yeah.
And the employers try to give the bare minimum of money that they can do to get the most work. That's the material relationship, unfortunately. Generally, there's some exceptions. Okay, so Arjuna starts out asking, what is matter? What is the field? Because Krishna hasn't talked too much about it, has he? Not a whole lot. I mean, he said that I'm the origin of everything, right? He's described that there's three energies. He's talked a little bit about reincarnation. Where has he talked about reincarnation? Second chapter and eighth chapter. He's talked a little bit about it, but he hasn't gone into depth. And he's, you know, generally said that you don't do your duties out of lust, but he really hasn't explained. You know, he's talked about, of course, also the fall down sequence. He hasn't really explained these things in depth. So now Arjuna wants to know more. And this is also, we can say that practically speaking, all the knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita is something that you just won't find other places. I mean, even just the Krishna saying you're not this body in the second chapter. If you go to most religious leaders in the world and say, who am I? You're not going to get that much of a solid answer. You're really not. And then what to speak of the middle six chapters where Krishna is talking about who is God. You're not going to find out much about that either. But when it comes to these last six chapters, this you're not going to find at all. I don't know of any other religion or religious philosophy on the planet that's, I mean, obviously other people who are followers of the Vedas are teaching these things to some extent. But other than that, I don't know of any that teaches what is the nature of the world. How does the world work? Just not there. And of course there's Prabhupada mentions in this section of the Bhagavad Gita that this is described far more elaborately. I mean, what's here is so much greater than you're going to find anyplace else. And then what's here, Prabhupada says, is just a summary. You know, if you really want to study Sankhya, if you really want to study the nature of the world, then where is it in the Bhagavatam? Third canto, yeah, Kapila Dev. You got Kapila Dev, just put it in the fourth instead of the third. So the third canto, and also what other part of the Bhagavatam? It's a very hard part of the Bhagavatam to read. Those of you who've gone from start to finish, the place where you went, oh, I don't know if I understand any of this. How am I going to get through this section? What canto is that? Anybody gone from start to finish? The second canto. Second canto is full of, there's hardly any stories in there. And it's... It's very, very philosophical. It's very, very philosophical, second canto. When I first read Bhagavatam, when I was reading the second canto, I thought, well, I'm just supposed to go from start to finish, so you know, I'm just going to get through this. And I was so happy when the pastime of Lord Varaha came. Oh, story. But the Sankhya philosophy is explained in depth in the second and third canto of the Bhagavatam. So if you're really interested, if you're really a philosopher, a scientist and you want to understand these things in more depth, that's where they are. So the third chapter, Krishna starts out with saying that the body is like the field, the soul is like the knower, who's what in relationship to a field? Yeah, but okay, just a field is like this place. So this, what would you call this? Would you call this a flat that you're in? This section of the building. A flat? It's more than a flat. It's a lot more than a flat.
Sweet.
Okay, that's good. It's more than a sweet too. But anyway, all right. So this sweet flat, whatever it is, the sweet flat. This is like the body. And what's like the soul? The people in it who are what? Do you own this place? No, you are what?
Tenants.
You're renting, you're tenants. How do you know that you're a tenant and not the owner? You can get kicked out. You can get kicked out. And my daughter and her family were renting a house at Govardhan. And one day, the landlord came and he said, you guys have to move in 5 days. So that's how you know that you don't own it. Didn't that just happen with the men's ashram? They said you had to move out, and then they said, now you have to move out earlier, or now you have to move out earlier. And what, can you do anything? Not usually, you know. You can try to take them to court, maybe. So that's how we know that we're the tenants. Can we be kicked out of this body at any time? Is it negotiable? Not really. Not really. So we're the tenants. And who's the owner?
Krishna.
Krishna. You know who's the owner, because the owner can throw you out and take repossession. Right? I want to use this body for something else. I want it to become dirt to grow trees in. And then, okay, you know, there we go. Amazing, huh? We're so attached to this body, and one day Krishna's going to say, I'd really like this dirt, this body to become some soil. I think it's much more important than what you're using it for. And we have to go, yeah, okay, you know, no problem. Or I want it to become meals for the hungry worms I have to feed. Wow. Wow. You know, we think this body is so important. Maybe one day Krishna's going to say, I have a far better use for it. Oh, what do you want to use it for? Worm food. So Krishna also compares nature to the mother, and he to the father, and we to the children. And Prabhupada talks about this sort of thing a lot, that real science is teaching that there has to be a father. He makes this point a lot. People who say that there's no God, he says that's like saying there's no father. Now, everybody knows, if you see a pregnant woman, that there's a father. We may not know who the father is, but we know that there's a father. So this is one of the ways that we can understand that there must be a God. Just like trees are coming from the earth, but they come from the earth, not just from the earth, they come from a
seed.
Had to be a seed. Couldn't just be soil. All right, and then Krishna says that he's detached from this whole thing. And he says something really amazing. He says, if you can understand how I am detached, you can also be detached. Because we're part of him. If we can understand how he's detached. And the way I think about, I give this example a lot, the way I think about it is, this material nature is compared in the Shastras to a dream, and in modern society we can easily compare it to a movie or a video game. And in one sense, a movie or a video game is a little bit easier to understand, because when I'm having a dream, if I dream about you, for example, you don't have the same dream. So I can understand that my dream isn't real because I'm the only one having it, even if I have it about all of you. But with this world, we're all sharing an experience, at least to some extent. I mean, each of us is going to come away from this time with a little bit different take on what happened in this class. You find that out when sometimes people say, did you say this and this? Like, whoa. So people have little different experiences. But basically, we're sharing an experience. And if we get together and watch a drama, or we get together and watch a movie, or we get together and play a video game, we're sharing an experience, which is an illusion. And it's also a nice example because the movie or the video game or the drama is real, but it's not what we are experiencing as being. Right? We're experiencing, we're watching the movie, that people are jumping off cliffs and saving the world and so many things. And what's really, what's actually happening? Hmm? They're acting. It's just actors. And are they acting right now in a movie? No. They acted sometime in the past. And so what's happening right now? What's actually happening right now? If you're watching a movie right now, what's actually happening?
Sitting looking at a screen.
You're looking at a screen, and what's on the screen?
Images.
Lights. No, lights. Three different colors of lights. That's it. Three different colors of lights. Isn't that interesting? Right? Three different colors of lights moving together. And we're thinking, and not only are we, if we're watching it, we become absorbed in it, and do we start feeling the emotions that the director wanted us to feel? That's the whole purpose of the movie. An expert director, producer, they've made a movie so that you're experiencing different emotions. They're thinking, at this point, I want everybody to cry. At this point, I want everybody to laugh. At this point, I want everybody to be scared. And it's a good movie if that happens. Correct? Is that correct? All right. Now, what about... you go into a shop and you're looking to buy a monitor, you're looking to buy a television set, and they have many televisions in the shop. And what do they have on the televisions? Various movies, right? Because they want you to see the quality of the merchandise. Is the shopkeeper, most likely, is the shopkeeper watching them? Probably not. Probably not. The shopkeeper is detached. The shopkeeper is detached. Or even the director. Who here has ever directed a play? Anyone here ever directed a play? One person, two people, okay. So when you're watching the play that you've directed, are you absorbed in the emotions of the play usually? No. No, you're not. You're just thinking, okay, oh no, she just forgot her lines. You know, and you tend not to be so absorbed. So Krishna's not absorbed. He's the shopkeeper, or he's the director, and he's not absorbed in the movie. He's not absorbed in the movie. And if we understand that, we can also be not absorbed. Just like you can walk in the shop and you're not absorbed in the movies. The same movie that if you saw it in a theater with a group of people, you'd be crying at that point. The same point shows up in the shop and you're not crying at all. Right? You walk past and, oh, he just died. Oh my God, my son died. And you're like, okay. You know, or you drive past an automobile accident and you see somebody's being taken in a stretcher into an ambulance. Do you cry? Not usually. Not usually. Or if you check the news regularly, you know, practically every day, suicide bombing in Baghdad, 20 people killed. Do you cry when you read the headlines? Not usually. Right? But if you got a phone call, you know, your brother just got killed in a suicide bombing in Baghdad, then you would probably cry. Right? Am I right? So Krishna is detached. He's not identifying with this world. And similarly, we can be detached. And Krishna is saying that all that's happening here, just like on a movie, all that's happening are three colors. And all that's happening here is what? The three modes of nature. That's it. Three modes of nature. And when mostly goodness is on the screen, how do we feel? Happy. Just like the director of a movie. Okay, at this point, the audience is going to feel happy. At this point, the audience is going to feel fearful. At this point, right? Doesn't that happen? That's what a novel. You know, good storyteller, they have it that they're planning it like that. And that's how they judge when they test it on an audience. If people don't laugh at this point or don't cry at this point, then they adjust it. So it's when the mode of goodness comes on the screen, we feel happy, we feel peaceful. What happens when the mode of passion is dominating on the screen? We feel anxiety. We feel what? I got to get things. Got to accomplish things. I got to work hard. Right? Got to get this, and I got to get this, and I got to, what about this, and what about that, and what about that, and what happens when more ignorance comes on the stream? Sleep, intoxication, depression, criminal activity, sinful activity. Of course, this is happening during the day. There's one brief period of time, by the way, when all the modes are in equilibrium, early in the morning, which we try to take advantage of for our chanting. And after that, what mode is dominant early in the morning? Goodness. By the way, if people aren't very inclined in the mode of goodness, what do? In the mode of goodness? They sleep. They sleep. If you have no attraction to the mode of goodness, then as soon as the mode of goodness is dominant, just like people who like to watch horror movies, you know, if there's some really nice, philosophical, loving movie, they don't even go to it. If they go to it, they're like, this is really dumb. Where's all the violence, you know? There's no action in this movie. So people who are not inclined to goodness, they really have a hard time. See this in the big cities. People will be up till 2 or 3 in the morning. They go to bed just when the mode of goodness starts to become dominant. It's quite interesting. They can't function anymore. You know, they can't relate to those emotions. And then the mode of passion starts becoming active, you know, a little bit after the sun rises. And what do? They all go to work. It's quite difficult to sit down and chant your japa between like 10 and 2 in the middle of the day. And those of us who chant Gayatri know the noon Gayatri is always the most difficult. You know, okay, I got to take out time and sit down and chant the Gayatri. Because the mode of passion is very active. That's when you should eat your big meal in the middle of the day, Ayurvedically. Right? And then the evening mode of ignorance comes into effect, and those of us who are not so much in ignorance, what do when the mode of ignorance is dominant? We sleep. And people who are very much inclined to ignorance, they become active. And oh, great, they feel energized. They feel energized by ignorance. You know, let me go drinking, let me have illicit sex, and if it's really bad, let me commit crimes. So, and that's all that's going on. The modes are being active, and the living entity who's watching and desiring becomes influenced by these modes. And there's some general modes that are acting on everyone at the same time, and then there are different modes acting on each of us according to the kind of body that we have. So we have a body that's a combination of certain modes, and that inclines us in a certain way. It's almost like we're each watching a little different movie. You know, one of these multiplex theaters where you can choose like 10 movies, or a big bookstore, you know, where you can choose, do I want the books in the philosophy section, and do I want the books in the romance section, or do I want the books in the horror section, right? And you pick up a book and you become absorbed in a book. So we have a little book of our story. Sometimes there's children's books where you can put your own self in the book. You know, so this is a book of our story, and we're absorbed, and we're just following along and thinking, yes, this is me. And all of them, Krishna says, lead to rebirth, even the mode of goodness. And he says that freedom comes if you're detached and neutral. If you're detached and neutral. And Krishna then goes from the 13th chapter, he describes the modes of nature in a general way. Then in the 14th chapter, he describes them in a little bit more specific way. So 13th and 14th are really describing the modes of nature. And at the end of the 14th chapter, Arjuna asks a question very much like he asked at the end of the second chapter, which is? Very good. That was the beginning of 12th chapter. Very good. What is beginning 14th chapter? Krishna's now all described the modes of nature and said you should be detached from it. So we've just described, look, folks, what you think is your real life is just a movie. You're just sitting in the theater. And the person directing the movie is sweeping you along. And you're feeling emotions, they're not even your emotions. You're thinking that it's your story, it's not your story. It's a character's story. You're thinking it's your story, and you're thinking it's your emotions, and you're just being carried on these modes of material nature. And the only thing you're doing is deciding which movie to watch and how much to pay attention, you know. That's all you're doing, and you have your own life. And the reason you're suffering is because at this point in the movie, the character's suffering. You're not actually suffering. It's just the three colored lights happening here. It's just the observer, the colored lights on the screen, and the person running the projector and making the movie. So what's Arjuna's question then? Not yet.
How to become detached.
You ever see anybody addicted to computer games? I think it's almost like a drug. You know? I think no intoxication. We not only have chemical drugs, but there's also electronic drugs. You know, there was a book many, many years ago about television called The Plug-In Drug. And, you know, years ago we used to just mostly say the dangers of television, but now it's woof, right? And a person, they're just addicted to computer games. And I've seen devotees get addicted to computer games. Yes, I have. I've seen devotees get addicted to television and all kinds of things. I've seen devotees who get addicted to computer games. And they'll tell you, this is bad for my spiritual life, it's bad for me, but it's hard for me to give it up. And just yesterday at your program, I was talking to one gentleman who obviously comes here a lot. He goes to a lot of other temples. And I said, so you chant? He said, well, yeah, but I don't like to chant too much because it's so powerful. He said, as soon as I chant a lot, then I see that the world is an illusion. He said, and the problem is, I like the illusion. He said, I know it's an illusion, but I like the illusion. You know, he said, I'm afraid. He kept talking about fear. Kept saying, I'm afraid to give it up. And that is more or less the same situation that's true for any of us who are not pure. If we want to know why we're not pure, it's because ultimately we don't have enough what? What was it that we're doing this to develop again?
Desire.
We don't have enough desire. Why don't we have enough desire? Because we're afraid. We're afraid. We're attached and we're fearful. Therefore, we don't have enough desire. Right? That makes sense? So getting detached is not easy. We have some idea, okay, I'd like to be detached, but we don't have a strong enough desire to be detached. We're fearful. So many things. So Arjuna asks, how do you become detached? What's Krishna's answer? Very important verse in Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th chapter. Well, so with this man at the Sunday program, how could he become detached? How would he get that higher taste? By doing what?
Devotional
service. Is he specifically avoiding doing too much devotional service? He does just some. There are many people like this. And there are even people who get initiated who end up becoming like this. Okay? You know, sometimes I think you guys here, you're to some extent geographically isolated. So I'm trying to give you some idea of what can happen so you can avoid it. You follow? You follow? I've thought many times, you know, what's the use of people like me who've been hanging around for a while? Like a tree, you know, hanging around. So I've seen what can happen. I've seen what can happen positively. I know of many, many devotees who are experiencing the higher aspects of Krishna consciousness, who are experiencing Nishtha and Ruchi and Ashakti and Bhava. I mean, not many percentage-wise, but many in numbers. And I also see many, many devotees who become discouraged in some way or take up something lesser, you know, or go in have various pitfalls. So this becoming detached is difficult. And Krishna says, to do it, mamcha yo vyabhicharina bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitam brahma bhuyai kalpate. You have to engage in devotional service without falling down. In other words, you're going to surpass the modes of material nature when you're at nishta, when you're steady. When you're steady. And how to do that? He already said that in the 12th chapter. How do you become steady? By performing what? Abhyasya. Okay. So Krishna says, you'll surpass the modes of nature when you're steady. Shiva Maharaj says his latest book, which is Sudha Bhakti Chintamani, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. Maharaj has combined the explanation of Shraddha to Prema from many, many different sources, and he's sort of reorganized it in his own way. And it's a really helpful manual for devotees. I highly, highly recommend that book. But when he's talking about going from unsteady Krishna consciousness to steady Krishna consciousness, which is also the question that we hear over and over and over and over and over. Boy, I had that enthusiasm and that bliss. How do I keep it? Right? How do I keep from going up and down? How do I keep my determination? Right? Do we all want to know this?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. And he talks about that until we're steady, we'll be attacked by these modes. And it's embarrassing, isn't it? Isn't it embarrassing? You know, you're attacked by the modes. You get depressed. You get hopeless. Or you get angry. Or you just kind of, the world's a nice place. I'm just gonna, you know, grow organic veggies and be happy in the world or whatever. yeah, yeah, I'm a devotee, life's good, and you just kind of become complacent, blissfully complacent, you know. And then you realize it and you feel so embarrassed. Oh, my God, how did I get so angry? How did I get so upset with this person? Why did I get like this, isn't it? Don't we feel embarrassed being beset by these modes? And when we get to the point of steadiness, then Krishna tells us we're not affected by the modes anymore. In that purport, 1422, very, very, very important purport. Please memorize the first paragraph of that purport if you can, where Prabhupada says there, as long as you have a body, the body is going to be affected by the modes. The body and mind are going to be affected by the modes. The body's inclined to sleep when the mode of ignorance gets dominant, isn't it? The body's inclined to do active work when the mode of passion is dominant. And the body's inclined to doing meditative type things when the mode of goodness is dominant. That's our inclination. That's not going to stop, even if you become nishta, even if you come to the point of Brahma-Bhuta. The body is still going to be affected like that. But what will you become? You'll be detached. It's like in the shop, the movies are still going to be playing on the monitors. But you're not watching it. You're not absorbed in it. You may notice it. Oh, the guy just got killed in that movie. Right? But you're not thinking that I care about this guy that got killed in that movie. You become like an observer. Actually, we already are an observer. Do you ever experience that? Do you ever feel like an observer of yourself? Because that's actually what we are. We're really an observer. We're not really this body and mind. So Prabhupada says there that one stops trying to either enjoy the body or get out of the body. They just don't really care. Okay, that's there. But I'm not going to go with it. As he said earlier, like rivers flowing into the ocean, which is always being full, but which is still. Can we do this artificially? No, you can't do it artificially. I tried. Many of you ever tried? Yeah. Yeah. And then just a big blast of passion and ignorance comes along and it's all over, you know. And then you're embarrassed again. I thought I was advanced. So, Hare Krishna. So you can't do it artificially, but we should know what the goal is. We should know what the goal is and we should be aiming for it. We should be aiming for it. And as I said yesterday, we should start to learn to recognize Maya earlier and earlier and earlier. And how do you do that? And as soon as you recognize it, act on it. And then Krishna will reveal to you earlier and earlier and earlier. And then Arjuna asks, what are the symptoms of one who's transcended? And the end of the 14th chapter, Krishna gives the symptoms. So if you want to know the specific behaviors, thoughts, and feelings of a Krishna conscious person, where are you going to find this? We've mentioned now three places in the Bhagavad Gita where you're going to find this. Second, end of the second chapter. 14th, which I just said, end of the 14th. And in the middle part of the Bhagavad Gita, it's at the end of the 12th. End of the 12th. Second, 12th, 14th. End of all three of those chapters. What are the specific behaviors? What are the specific thoughts? What are the specific feelings? Where am I going? Where's my goal? What is this pure devotional service I'm aiming for anyway? What does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? Okay? And of course, there's further descriptions then given other places. But that's where you'll find that. All right, now you might say, whoa, it's really difficult. One thing that happens to me when I read those sections is I go, whoa, I am really far away from this stuff. You know, it's a nice dose of humility reading those descriptions of the self-realized soul. And Krishna, the 15th chapter, describes why it's so hard. He says that the material world is like a? Oh, well. It very well may be. But beginning of the 5th chapter, by the way, I'm really happy that you're willing to try things, even if it may be wrong, because the only way to learn is to be willing to try. If we're so afraid that I'm going to make a mistake that we don't try, then we don't learn as much. So, thank you. Thank you very much. I got to make sure I got the answer right before I say anything. You know, you don't learn nearly as much. Okay, he compares the material world to a what? Anybody know? Beginning of 15th chapter? A banyan tree that's upside down. Who here has seen a banyan tree? A photo. Who's actually seen one right in front of their face? Wow. There's one in Calcutta, I've been told, where they say they'll give a prize to anyone who can find the original trunk. And I've seen huge ones in Hawaii. absolutely huge, that just go on and on and on. And are those two trees together or four trees together? Is it one tree? And they have Chinese and Indian ones there, and the Indian ones spread out more, and there are very complicated trees because the roots come down from the branches, and you can't figure out what's the roots and what's the branches, and, you know, I don't know how you get rid of one of those trees. It must be pretty hard to remove one of those trees if you wanted to do it, right? Krishna says, of all trees, I'm the banyan tree. So it's pretty hard to get out because we're in this banyan tree and it's upside down. So there was this very tight knot called the Gordian knot. Any of you remember rehearing in school about the Gordian knot? And there was a legend that anyone who could untie that knot would conquer the world. Right? And many people tried. I'm sure we've all had knots we couldn't get out. Right? So you're trying and trying, wires tangled together. Right? My son in California had to move recently, talking about tenants and landlords. So his landlord came along and said, I'm selling the place, so he had to move. And his biggest lamentation was that he had arranged all of his wires, that he'd have to, you know, undo all the wires and rearrange them. He was more worried about that than moving the furniture. So, right, sometimes we have all of our wires, they've become knotted, or we have string that's in a knot, right? And you just try and untangle it. Right? So Alexander the Great, he came to this Gordian knot, and what did he do? Do you know? What did he do? Cut it. He took a sword and he cut it, and he said, now I am going to conquer the world. So that's Krishna's suggestion. Krishna's suggestion is not untangle the banyan tree. And people try to do this. That's what psychology is all about. And yes, psychology is useful in a temporary way for some things, undoubtedly. But you're not going to get out of the material world with psychology. I mean, it's just like, you know, antibiotics are useful too, but they're not going to get you out of the material world. Plaster casts are useful, you know, surgery is useful. But it's not going to bring you liberation. So psychology is not going to get... And you can do psychology for your past 100 lifetimes. Really, people get into this, don't they? Even sometimes devotees get into this. You know, it may be useful to understand. Again, it's not that it's not useful. But that's not the solution. Okay, well, I did this in this life, and I did this in this life, and this life. And all you're getting in the tree. You follow? Psychology is useful if it helps you to surrender to Krishna. That's useful. But if you're just getting into, well, I feel guilty about this and this, this. Krishna says, cut it down, and cut it down with what? The weapon of?
Knowledge.
Knowledge and detachment. Knowledge and detachment. And Krishna again gives us this knowledge. Again, in the 15th chapter, he gives descriptions of himself. So where are the descriptions of himself in relationship to the world? 7th, 10th, 9th, and 15th. 7th, 9th, 10th, and 15th. Because you may say, well, I'm in the banyan tree. I can't see God. He said, see me in the sunshine. See me in the moonshine. See me in when you have knowledge, when you have remembrance, when you have forgetfulness. Many times people would ask Prabhupada, have you seen God? And Prabhupada would say, can't you see God? Don't you see the sunshine? Right? And then at the end of the 15th chapter, which is Purushottam Yoga, where Krishna says, there's fallible and infallible, and I am above them all. Right? I am above them all. And then you might say, well, okay, Krishna's going back to this sort of duality of the divine and demoniac in the 16th chapter. Those who stay in the banyan tree are the demoniac, and those who want to get out are the divine. And he starts off in the beginning of the 16th chapter listing divine qualities. And it's a long purport, but it's a very, very helpful purport. Oh, I just realized I forgot to say something about the 13th chapter. It's a very, very helpful purport because Prabhupada describes each of those qualities in relationship to specific varnas and ashramas. So like the main quality that the brahmacharis have to do, the main quality the grihasthas have to do, the main qualities that the brahmins and kshatriyas and shudras. So that everybody should develop all those qualities. They specifically deal with different varnas and ashramas. And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit because I realize I forgot something important. In the 13th chapter, the beginning, Krishna lists the qualities of knowledge, which are somewhat similar to the divine qualities. And that means the way you attain knowledge. When Krishna's talking about knowledge, he's talking about how do you attain knowledge. People think they attain knowledge by studying hard, by having a high IQ. But Krishna says the way you attain knowledge is by being things like humble and detached and taking shelter of a spiritual master. That's how you get transcendent. That's the process for how you get transcendent knowledge. Sorry, I forgot about that. Okay, so he describes the divine qualities, and then he describes the demoniac qualities. And I'm sorry to say that one thing that you'll understand as you progress in Krishna consciousness is that probably you have some of those demoniac qualities. You know? It's a sad story. Right? That if we didn't have some demoniac qualities, we wouldn't be a conditioned soul. Now, we may not go around killing our enemies, I hope. I hope we're not killing our enemies. But we may be trying to neutralize people that we see as our enemies. Maybe trying to make them impotent or discredit them in some way. And this happens even in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Devotees try to discredit each other or criticize each other or jockey for position or so many things. Right? Who was telling me? One sannyasi was telling me that he was, I think it was Kadambakananda Swami, that he was the vice president of a temple. And he was talking to the temple president who was sitting behind his desk, and the temple president said, "I know what you want. You want to sit in my chair." And I know that because when I was sitting there, I wanted to sit in my chair. And he said, I'm out of here. He said, I'm not having anything to do with this. So this sort of thing goes on. It's not that it doesn't go on. It does go on. So what is the divine and demoniac nature? And many times what I've come to see is that my motives for doing things are often demoniac. My way of operating the world is often demoniac. Okay. I remember saying one time this at... when I was at a seminar, one of the devotees pulled me out afterwards and saying, "You shouldn't say that." I said, "But Prabhu, it's true." "But what can you do about it?" So it's not something to get depressed about, but just to look at it and say, "Hey, you know, that's not really what I want to do. That's not the kind of person I want to be. I really want to be something else." So Arjuna at the end of that chapter says, "Well, is that it? Is there only divine and demoniac? Is there anything in between?" Well, what does Krishna give as the main demarcation for divine and demoniac? He gives one external and one internal. Yes. The external way is, do you follow the Shastra? Do you follow the scriptures? So that's who's a good citizen, who's a good criminal? Do they follow the laws? Pretty simple, right? And the mood? What is the difference in mood between the divine and demoniac? And the divine person has some consciousness of God. Some consciousness of God. They know God is the Supreme Person, and they're trying to have some relationship with him of service. So then Arjuna says, well, is there anything else besides these two? We see there's shades of gray, aren't there? Right? And now Krishna in the 17th chapter, and there's some also in the 18th chapter, he gives lists of all different things according to the three modes. There was a little bit of this in the 14th chapter, but now he's going to, and also in the 18th, 17, 18, this in the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance, this thing in the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance, this thing in the mode of goodness, passion, this thing in the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance, and I've made a whole chart. What are all the different things according to the modes? Right? And you might want to do that, to study. And of course, this is helpful because this helps us to see, you know, what modes is influencing me at this particular time. And then Krishna is talking about, because this is talking mostly about faith, and he ends by saying, the best faith in me, and the last verse in the 17th chapter, he says, anything that's done without faith in God is essentially useless. It's asat. It's essentially useless. And he talks about om tat sat, that everything should be done om tat sat. Thank you very much, Emma. Hope you have a lovely day at work. Sorry I didn't quite make it to the 18th chapter. Tried. So om, everything that's dedicated to the Supreme. Tat, I am dedicating this. Sat, it's something eternal. It's something of value. I am dedicating this thing of real value to the Supreme. And Prabhupada would sometimes write om tat sat at the bottom of his letters and things like that. Everything is dedicated to the Supreme. There's a school in England run by Mayavadis. Pleasant people, though. They really like devotees. Very, very pleasant people. They kind of are trying to mix Christianity and Sankaracharya. And their school it's a lovely school, just lovely. I mean, it's a place that I went and I thought, yes, this is the kind of school we should do for Krishna. It's What a nice place. All the kids learn Sanskrit. And because the young children are not yet very contaminated by their Mayavadi philosophy. And I went to one of their classes where they were singing Sanskrit grammar. And they were declining the noun Rama. And they were doing it in song. And I felt like I was among the devas in heaven, the way they were singing. It was so beautiful. But anyway, they dedicate each of their classes to God. So they start and end every class by saying, all the children, and these are Western children mostly, a few Indians, but mostly British children. They start out, Om Paramatmane Namaha. I dedicate this to the Paramatma. At the beginning they say thus, and at the end they say that in Sanskrit. So I'm going to dedicate this activity to Paramatma. I have dedicated, at the end of each class, I have dedicated this activity to Paramatma. So of course, they think that they're the Paramatma. Well, that's a little... The adults do. I mean, they don't start teaching the kids that kind of stuff till they're about 12, although it permeates their curriculum. But still, their example is very nice, isn't it? Very, very nice example. And of course, it's a vegetarian school. And so they really, really try to be in the mode of goodness. I mean, and I'd say to a large extent that they succeed. It's quite an interesting place. It's called St. James School. It's right in London. And they have many sister schools throughout the world, although I've never visited any of those. And the head of the school really, really likes devotees. I mean, he gave me a lot of his time, a tremendous amount of his time to show me the school, show me the curriculum. And their Sanskrit curriculum is some of the best in the world, which we're now selling at krishna.com. And it's really excellent. The only problem I found with it is when they draw pictures of Krishna, they're kind of weird. I mean, you could see that bhakti makes a difference. You know, Krishna wasn't present in those pictures. It was quite interesting. But the Sanskrit course is really, really excellent. They have some top quality people there. And of course, they get some prasadam and things like that. Anyway, my point is that they were thinking, we're going to dedicate our activities to the Lord. We're going to dedicate our activities to the absolute truth. So we also need to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that before everything you do, you sit down and go, Tatsat. Well, you could. You certainly could. But just like Prabhupada has us at the beginning of our activities, have a kirtan. Right? That's the idea that we're dedicating everything to Krishna. Some reminder, I'm dedicating everything to Krishna. I was reading a blog by Umapati Swami. He said he wrote a letter to a disciple saying, think of your home as belonging to Guru and Krishna, and that you're just a servant. And then he thought, oh, maybe I can do that. And as soon as he thought that, he said, he looked out at, what was it, Bangkok, and it looked like Vrindavan. So some kind of reminder, I'm dedicating this to Krishna, I'm dedicating this to Krishna. All right, now we go to the 18th chapter, which Arjuna starts out by asking, what is renunciation? What are the different kinds of renunciation? And here Krishna summarizes the whole Bhagavad Gita. There are sections in the 18th chapter that you can correspond with Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, and Gyan Yoga. And he starts off by saying, you're not the doer. Have we heard this before? Yes, is this a theme that's running throughout the Bhagavad Gita? And here Krishna says, you're not the doer because there's how many doers? Five doers. What are they? Anybody remember them? The place?
Time.
Place and time. Super soul? I think place, it's all circumstance. Place, the endeavor? The work itself? Is that what you said?
The modes.
The work itself, the person, and the super soul. So there's five doers, not only us. Don't we see this in life? Right? But we're not the only doers. There's so many other factors. Yes? Okay, well, let's take a look. The place, which includes the body, so all the circumstances, the performer, the senses, what you're using to do something, the different kinds of work, and the super soul. So the place, what you're trying to do, the instruments you have to do it with, the person who's doing it, and Krishna. I was trying to show a video yesterday. It was the place, which includes my body, includes the equipment, the senses, includes my senses, and also some of the equipment will be included in that. What I'm trying to accomplish, my own desire, and the will of God. Well, desire is ultimately coming from the soul, which then, but that's in a general way, and it then takes a specific shape in the mind, and then is acting through the senses. But if you like, let me finish, and then we could discuss that, because that's a long discussion, and we'll get all the way off if we do that, and then you'll lose the flow. Okay, so we're not the doer. There's the five factors of actions. And Krishna's talking about everyone's work can be purified through offering. It talks about the Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, how everyone can become perfect through doing their own work if they dedicate it to Krishna. And then he says, if we don't work for him, we'll work anyway. Has he said this before? Yes. And he said, if we work for him, he'll guide us and protect us. And then he says, you know what, Arjuna? You had nothing to lose? Well, he said that in the second chapter. But after describing all this, you don't do it for me, you're going to do it anyway, and then you'll suffer. You do it for me, I'll take care of you and protect you. Now, Arjuna, you can
choose.
You can do what you like. And this choice is something we did just once, right? When are we making this choice? All the time. All the time. I remember one person asking me a question at Soho Street in London, saying, when we have really big decisions to make, how do we decide what's the right course of action? And my answer to him, which he didn't like at all, was, how do you know what the big decisions are? How do you know what's a big decision? You might say, well, who I have as my guru, who I marry, where I live are the big decisions. Your really big decision might be, do I get in the car to drive now or 5 minutes from now? That could be the biggest decision of your life, couldn't it? Right? I was driving once down the road, and a car missed hitting the driver's side by 2 seconds. What's the big decisions? What's the little decisions? I don't know. I can't figure it out. Seems to me every decision is potentially a big decision, isn't it? How I spend my particular time, what I think about, what I do, who I talk to, where I go. You never know which of those decisions changes the whole course of your life, do you? No. Amazing. Just amazing. You stop and talk to somebody, and that person tells you about a business opportunity, and you take it, and your whole life changes, and all you just stop and have a two-minute conversation. You know, you decide on some whim, well, I'm just going to stop by this shop, and you never stopped by the shop before in your life, and because you stopped by that shop, you're 15 minutes later than you would have been otherwise. And you get to the grocery store 15 minutes later than you had intended to, and you meet somebody that you haven't, you know, some devotee that you hadn't seen for 10 years who'd left the movement. Does this kind of thing happen? And you're like, who made that decision to stop at the shop anyway? What's happening here? Who's engineering all this stuff? Right? So we're making choices at every moment. And the really important choice we're making at every moment is not, do I get in the car in this 5 minutes, or even do I marry this person, but what's the really big choice that we're making every moment? Do I surrender to Krishna? Do I think about Krishna? Do I do everything for Krishna? Do I follow my guru? Not just whose picture do I have up, but do I follow them? You understand? So we're making this choice at every moment. And everything we do is a choice. One of the best pieces of advice I got was from this devotee, Chandrika, who had been a teacher when my two oldest children were very young. She said, you're always teaching a child something. She said, if you don't teach them to wake up early, then you're teaching them to?
Sleep in.
Woo-hoo, you were teaching them to wake up late. We don't think that way. We think, I'm just not teaching them to wake up early. Oh, I'm not concentrating on my rounds right now. Well, you're choosing to space out then, aren't you? Right? So you're always making some kind of a choice. As soon as we think, you know, well, I'm just being lazy and I'm not really deciding, putting it off. Putting it off is also a kind of decision. Right? Isn't it? This is one of the logical fallacies. A logical fallacy is saying, well, I just haven't made a decision. Then you're making a decision to wait. You understand? Mm-hmm. So we're always making a decision. I'm giving some material examples that we're always making a decision of whether or not to surrender to Krishna and how much to surrender to Krishna. We're always doing that at every moment. And that choice is ours. That choice is ours. We have some things that we do own. We don't own this body, and we don't own our clothes, and we don't own our computers. But there's something that we own. What do we own? We own our choice. That's ours. We keep that. And nobody's ever going to take that away. We always have our own choice. We always have our own desires. That's ours. It's always ours. Sometimes people say that they want Krishna to force them. No, you don't. I don't believe that. I really don't believe that. We all want freedom. The soul's free. A liberated, what does liberated mean? Free. I want to be a liberated soul by force? Does that make any sense? One of the most basic principles of Bhakti, Prabhupada says in the first canto, is freedom. It's freedom. We all have choice. As soon as we think even in terms of I have to do something, that's illusion. There's two things you have to do. What are the two things you have to do? You have no choice about. No? You don't have to? No? You have to exist. Desire is the most essential part of existence. You have to exist. You don't have to exist in this body, dear. But you do have to exist. You can't stop existing. Can Krishna put you in a state where it feels like you've stopped existing?
Yeah.
Yeah, he can do that. He can put you in a pretty comatose state for a long time if you want it. You know, at the end of the creation, it's like that. We go into this comatose state inside Mahavishnu. And he can put you in some species of life where you're practically unconscious, or you can be in the Brahmajyoti where you're practically unaware of your own existence. But you still exist. You never really merge. So we always have to exist. Can't stop existing. So any of you who've ever thought about suicide, you know, can't do it, folks. You have to exist. It's not going to work. And what's the other thing that we have to do?
Have to die.
No, you don't die.
You have to serve.
You don't die. Yes, you have to serve. Dying is an illusion. You don't die.
No,
you don't die. You never have to die. You don't die. Ever. Dying is an illusion. Dying means you walk out of one movie theater and go into another one. Yeah. That's all. You don't die. Changing your clothes. I hope you all changed your clothes from yesterday. Did you die? No. No. There's no such death doesn't exist. Death exists for the what? The body. That's not us. We don't die. So serve, yes, we have to exist. And we have to serve. Those two things, that's, if you don't like that, well, that's kind of tough. But otherwise, everything is based on our desire. Everything's based on our desire. And we do have choice. We do have free will. We do have freedom. Krishna is ultimately free, and we as part of him are also free. But then Krishna is overcome with love at this point, and he said to Arjuna, you can do whatever you like. And then after saying you can do whatever you like, if it's really someone you love, and you might say to them, you know, you can do whatever you like. If you want to stay here and serve Krishna, fine. If you want to go out in the material world, then you can do that. Then what might you say after that? But I think you really should do this. I think you really should do this. So Krishna afterwards, he says two things. He says again, manmana bhava madbhakta. Arjuna, do whatever you like, but please think of me and become my devotee, worship me and offer your obeisances to me. Please do this. And then he says, and please, just, what's the end? It's not quite the end, but surrender. Forget about everything else. Just surrender. I'll take care of everything. Don't worry. All your questions, all your doubts. I'll take care of it. Don't worry. So do what you like, but please do this. Please do this. And of course, then Krishna ends by saying, anyone who studies the sacred conversation worships him by intelligence, that one should preach this, and one should preach this to devotees, one should not preach it to envious persons. Right? And then, of course, Sanjaya ends by saying that when he's remembering this conversation, he's feeling a thrill at every moment. And Prabhupada says there that real spiritual life means to feel a thrill at every moment. And then he ends by telling Dhritarashtra, you know, if Krishna Arjuna is there, you guys are going to lose. Whenever Krishna Arjuna is there, there's going to be power, victory, and morality. I want to just end by talking about three places where there's repetition. Jiva Goswami talks about six ways of telling the real meaning of a scripture. What is the beginning verses? What are the ending verses? What are the newer surprising things? One of them is what is repeated. So can anybody tell me what's repeated? Almost word for word. What verses are repeated almost word for word? Yes. Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakta, which is in the 18th chapter and at the end of the 9th. And at the end of the 9th chapter, Krishna is also very emotional, like he is here at the end of the 18th. You know, just imagine you have your best friend and they can't decide, you know, whether they're going to like go out drinking or they're going to stay in the temple and chant Hare Krishna. Would you be a little emotional? So Krishna's a little emotional. Please, always think of me. At the end of the 9th chapter, he's also emotional because he's talking about, this is what the commentators describe, because he's talking about how exalted his devotee is. Remember that? He was saying he'd worship demigods or the Brahman, but he said, you can just offer me a leaf for water. And remember, he also said something else, that even if my devotees are very sinful, even if they're most abominable, still they're saintly. And all the commentators say that, how could Krishna say this? He must have been overwhelmed with emotion. My devotees are wonderful, even if they're abominable. So in that mood of great love for his devotees, of overwhelming love for his devotees, he speaks this verse, Man Mana Bhava Mad Bhakto. So the two times when this verse is spoken in the Bhagavad Gita, and they're almost identical, are times when Krishna is overwhelmed with love for his devotees. What other verse is twice? Almost identical. First two lines are twice. Yes. You want to give us the English? Do the English? That's all right. Anybody else have any idea? It's in the 18th chapter and the 3rd chapter. Oh, maybe you found another one. It's not what it says. Okay, well, there may be some more, but yeah? Yes, no, that's a group of verses. If you look at 3:30 to 33, look at chapter 3. If something's repeated, it must be important. Do good teachers repeat something that's important? Is Krishna probably a good teacher? So if he's repeating something, it probably is important, right? Of course, he's repeating some concepts also over and over again. But if you look at chapter 3, text 30, okay? And then also look at chapter 18, text 58. So let's look at chapter 3, 30 to 33. Therefore, O Arjuna, why don't we read these together? 30 to 33, page 197 in my book. Can we read these together? Therefore, O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims to proprietorship, and free from lethargy fight, those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. But those who, out of envy, disregard these teachings and do not follow them are to be considered bereft of all knowledge, befooled, and ruined in their endeavors for perfection. And one more, even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. For everyone follows the nature he has acquired from the three modes. What can repression accomplish? Now let's look at 18, 58, 59, and 60. Can we read this together? If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditional life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. If you do not act according to my direction and do not fight, then you will be falsely directed. By your nature, you will have to be engaged in warfare. Under illusion, you are now declining to act according to my directions, but compelled by the work born of your own nature, you will act all the same, O son of Kunti. So these verses say pretty much the same thing. If you follow what I say, you'll be happy. If you don't, you'll be miserable. And you know you have your nature, you're going to do it anyway. It's not like you really don't have the option of not doing it. Your options are do it in a selfish, materialistic way, or do it for me. Those are really your options. Your option is not stopping your nature. So this is sort of a key concept in terms of our own practical life. Sometimes we see devotees try to change their nature or stop their nature. Is that what Krishna is telling us to do? No, he's saying use your nature for me. Please don't waste time trying to change your nature. It's a complete waste of time. According to God. He says it's not going to work. So I really think it's a waste of time. And I see many times devotees try to change their mundane nature. Please don't do that. Use it for Krishna. Let's take an example. Okay? Let's take an example. Are there some people, and you don't have to raise your hands, but are some of you really energized by difficult, challenging things? And some of you are probably discouraged by really difficult, challenging things. I know as a teacher, if I would say to my students, this assignment, folks, is going to be really easy. We've done it a lot of times before. You shouldn't have any difficulty with it. A bunch of the kids would go, great. And a bunch of them would go, why should I even bother? And if I said, you know, this lesson's going to be a little challenging. It's going to be a little difficult. You're really going to have to apply yourself. There's some new concepts here. They're kind of hard. Again, some of the kids would go, why even bother? And some of them would go, great. Okay? This is just one example of many different ways of describing a person's nature. So some people really like to have things very set. They don't like a lot of change and surprises in their life. They want to have a very, very standard, regulated life. They don't like to take a lot of risks before they do something. They want to take a lot of time, do a lot of research. They're very, very cautious. Is being cautious a good quality? Is being steady a good quality? Then there are people who are real risk takers. They want to do something exciting and adventurous. They're like change. And if they see something that might work, they'll try it, and they're not afraid to fail. They'll try 1,000 things, right? Just on the hope that one of them is successful. So we call that courage. Is that a good quality? Mm-hmm. Yes. Can you be both courageous and cautious in the same minute? No. You can't be, can you? And each of us tend to be a little bit more of one of those than the other. All of us have some courage and some caution. If you're only cautious, you never move. And if you're only courageous, you jump off cliffs. So it's, you know, most people have some of both. But each of us is probably more one than the other. All right, let's look at that according to the modes. Let's say courage, first of all. How could you be a risk-taking person in the mode of ignorance? Taking drugs. What else?
Running away on your wedding day.
Okay. That might be mode of passion. What?
Driving while drunk.
Driving while drunk. Okay. What else? Committing crimes. Okay. How could you be a risk taker in the mode of passion? I think that's what it is.
Adultery.
I'm sorry?
Adultery,
I think that's ignorance. Maybe ignorance and passion. Big business deals. Big risky business deals. Yeah.
Stock market. Investing in stocks.
Investing in stocks. With some intelligence, obviously, you know, not just like blindly. That would probably be ignorance. A lot of your big businessmen are risk takers in the mode of passion, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How could you be a risk taker in the mode of goodness? No, this is. I hope it's above goodness, and I hope this wasn't very risky.
No, by doing a duty despite
me an example of a specific person, what they might do? Someone who really takes risks in the mode of goodness? Yes?
They might be informed of the knowledge, but they might be knowledgeable about what they're doing.
They would know about what they're doing, yeah?
Charity work?
Yes, charity work. Mm-hmm. What about people who do charity work in the middle of a war zone? They're risking their life to help other people. Do we glorify such people?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do they sometimes get maimed or killed or whatever? Okay. How can you be a risk taker for Krishna? Maybe. Preaching, like, give me a circumstance where preaching would be taking a risk for Krishna.
Like people in Russia?
Yeah, the devotees in Russia. Preaching in a Muslim country. Starting in new temples, like, you know, this couple who's going to go to this other place and start a, right? I was talking to them last night. We're going to go to this place and start a temple. Do you think highly cautious people do that? No. No, that's taking a risk for Krishna. Yes. By trusting God, everybody should trust Krishna. Everybody should trust Krishna. Okay, so if you're a risk taker by nature, we don't say become a cautious person. That's a waste of time. It's not going to happen. It just won't happen. It's just like getting a different color hair. You know, you can dye your hair, but dyed hair, does it always look a little phony? You can usually tell when someone's got dyed hair, right? Sometimes you can if they've just done it and done a really expert job, but usually you can tell the natural blondes from the dyed blondes, can't you? And what always shows? The roots, right? Your real nature always ends up coming out. You have to keep covering it. So if you're a risk-taking person, don't waste your time thinking, well, if I were a good devotee, I'd be much more cautious. No, if you're a good devotee, you'll use your risk-taking nature for Krishna. Do we have very advanced devotees in our movement who are high risk-takers? Oh, yeah. Can you name one of them?
Indrajumna
Maharaj. Sure, many, many. Okay, let's think of a cautious person. How could you be a really cautious person in the mode of ignorance?
Not do anything, disturbing the house.
Yeah, just a couch potato. Sit on your couch, collect welfare checks, you know. Never question what life's all about. Never get out of your ignorant comfort zone, basically. Yeah. What about a cautious person in the mode of passion? That'd probably be more ignorance. And I don't think a cautious person makes a whole lot of sense. A really cautious person. I don't think cautious people make a whole lot of sense.
They make sure they study the plan of what they want to do hundreds of times before they actually do it.
Before they actually do it. Well, that's in general. Cautious people do that in general. How would that manifest in the mode of passion? That's a general truth about cautious people.
Maybe like a compulsive disorder?
That would be ignorance. That would be real ignorance. I mean, that would be extreme ignorance.
I'm working in a bank. I have a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of
Yes, you're bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. Bureaucrats in the government tend to be very cautious people. Yeah, that would be something in passion.
Like a new mother.
Not necessarily, that's her job. She has to be careful. Someone who's taking care of their family, you know, they're doing the same work every day, they're very responsible, they're very dutiful. You know?
Is that goodness or passion?
That's passion.
And
wanting to be a righteous person within the world is the mode of passion. Your top person in the mode of passion is a very righteous king. That's your exemplar of passion. If you think the topmost passion is someone who's really, really into righteousness. They're really, really into Dharma. Shudras are interested in Kama. Vaishyas are interested in Artha. Kshatriyas are interested in Dharma. Brahmins are interested in Moksha. So anyone who's interested in righteousness, what in America the Christians call family values, they're talking about the mode of passion. not talking about the mode of goodness, talking about the mode of passion. And because our society is so ignorant, the mode of passion looks pretty good. You know, but it's the mode of passion. Wanting to take nice care of your family. I mean, you can do anything for Krishna. That's a different thing. But wanting to take nice care of your family, wanting to be known as a responsible, upright person in society, wanting to be honored for being righteous, that's all the mode of passion. So yes, somebody who just, they belong to the same clubs and they work the same job and they take care of their family, and so that would be a very cautious person in the mode of passion.
And they're concerned about what people think of them?
People in the mode of passion are very concerned with what people think of them, yes. Okay, how could you be a cautious person in the mode of goodness?
Be very careful about your service to Krishna.
That's not goodness. That's both. I'm just in goodness. Yes.
I'm watching the association and kind of like, you know, like you want to sit in bed.
Okay. Making sure that you do righteous things, that might be passion.
Buying only organic food.
You're very cautious about what you eat. I was thinking someone who's very cautious in the mode of goodness, if they were doing charity work, they'd probably do it something that was close to home, where they weren't putting themselves or their families at risk.
Like the bake sale at church.
Things like that, yeah. You know, or yeah, some lady who's been doing the bake sale at church every week for 30 years. You know, and the person who's, they're volunteering at their church or they're volunteering at the soup kitchen, and they're there, they're steady. Cautious people like that, they're very, very steady. Risk-taking people are not steady like that. I was talking to one of Indrajumna Swami's disciples, and she was saying, you know, a lot of people have trouble that he'll say, I'm going to do this at this time, and then he changes his plans at the last minute. And I said, he has to be like that. You couldn't have somebody who can travel anywhere in the world and preach on a moment's notice who would also have a set schedule. It's incompatible. You know, you want him to have a set schedule that he sticks to, and then you want him to be able to immediately go to, you know, Kazakhstan at a 2 seconds notice. Mm-hmm. How are you going to have both of those things coexisting in the same person? Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, they're there all the time. That you can count on them. They're there every week. What do we see this in Krishna consciousness? How can you be that kind of person in Krishna consciousness? What does that sort of person do? Pujaris, the people who've been pujaris for 30 years, 40 years, people who've stayed in the same temple, they've done the same service at the same time. Is that valuable?
Yeah, yeah.
If you ask those people, you know, preach like Indrajumna Swami, that'd be pretty hard for them, wouldn't it? And if you said to Indrajumna Swami, please just stay and do this, it would be very difficult. Now, obviously, if you're above the modes of nature, Prabhupada says you can do anything under the orders of Guru. But the basic principle is there. We have our nature. Are either one of those bad or good? Does that make it more clear? Don't bother to change your nature. If you're the kind of person who likes things steady and you don't like change and you like to do, you know, you want to know where everything is and you want to have a set thing, then do that for Krishna. Don't try to become like Jayapataka Swami. It's a waste of time. Don't think, well, you know, if I were really a pure devotee, I'd be like Jayapataka Swami. And if that's what you're like, then don't think, well, I've got to be like this pujari who's been here for 30 years or this cook who's been here for 30 years doing exactly the same thing every day. That you'll waste your energy doing something that's impossible. So please don't waste your human energy trying to become a different kind of personality. It's not you anyway. Just like this body isn't us, the personality we have in this life is not us either. Whether we're outgoing, whether we're reserved, whether we like doing jobs more or whether we like being with people more, whether we're more risk takers, whether we're more cautious, whether we motivate ourselves more with positive things, whether we motivate ourselves more with negative things, that none of that has anything to do with our eternal personality in the spiritual world. It's just like when you're in a drama, you get a costume and you also get a certain persona to play, right? Isn't it? If you're going to play, you know, Sherpanika in the play, then you have a certain... But that's not you, is it? I hope. I read once this man who was married to a famous actress. He said, I feel like I've been married to 1,000 different women. You know, she come home in that mood of the character. So we not only have a particular body, but we also have a particular mentality. But it's not, it changes. We don't have the same mentality in every life. And that's not our ultimate mentality. Whatever it is, use it for Krishna. That's Krishna's point here, and he's making it twice. He's making it in the third chapter, and he's making it in the 18th chapter. The point, Arjuna, he said, is not to try to change your nature. The point is to use your nature for me. And if you don't use your nature for me, it'll change, right, into another nature? No. If you don't use your nature for me, what will happen? You'll do it anyway. You'll do it anyway. So if you put your energy into trying to become a different kind of person, it won't work anyway. And instead of trying to do it for Krishna, you'll do it for Maya. So, yes?
Does that mean that he's basically saying to Arjuna that if you don't fight in this battle and go a human fashion, which isn't according to your nature, then you may try and bend it, won't work, and then eventually you'll have to be a fighter anyway.
You'll fight with somebody. Yes. Yeah, you'll fight with somebody.
I'm just wondering, in a marriage situation, maybe it's not completed because it's the special communication, and one person has it, there's two people with strong natures and tendencies, and you feel like the other person is...
Well, this question comes up a lot in general, not just in marriage, where people say, you know, I don't feel like I'm able to properly express my own nature. And obviously there's several things you can do. I'm going to make this a very short answer, and when you shorten complicated things, you naturally distort them. So as soon as you shorten something, you distort it to some extent, if it's very complex. The two basic parts to that answer is you think about what your real needs are. You don't just look at the externals of the situation. You look at your deeper needs to express your individuality. And you find ways, which I can't really discuss now, but you find ways of respectfully asking that other person if they would be willing, which means that you're willing to take a no. You find ways of respectfully asking that person if there are some specific things that they would be willing to do that would help you to meet your need for expressing your own nature. But before you can do that, you've got to go beyond the specifics of the situation to what are your deeper needs. And you need to really think about what specific things the other person could do that would help you to meet those needs. We all have a need to express our individuality because we're all spiritually individual people. That's not a material thing. It's a spiritual thing. And the other thing you can do is you can ask yourself, what more are you willing to do to find ways of using your nature in Krishna's service, even if your external situation doesn't change? So you can request the people that you have to work with. Request means you're willing to take a no. You can request the people that you're working with if they'd be willing to do some things that would help make it easier for you. And if they won't do that, because they have free will too, and they have individuality also, then you request yourself, are there things that I can do? And you will pretty much find always the answer is yes. I'll give you an example, which would make it more clear. So I was speaking to one woman who generally on Wednesdays goes to a class at her local temple. And she leaves the children with her husband, and she goes to the class. And it's her night out, you know? It's her night out. And she really looks forward to it. You know, all week she's looking forward to, I get to go to the Wednesday night class. And she really, it's the same person who gives a class every Wednesday night at the temple. It's a speaker that she really finds very inspiring. So she contacted me a few weeks ago and said, I'm really, you know, I'm ready to just kill this guy I live with. What's the problem? He didn't let me go to the class last night. I didn't ask why, you know, something obviously. He didn't want to watch the kids, or he had to do something. And then we got to, you know, what are you going to the class for? What needs of yours is going to the class meeting? And we came up with needs. You know, it's meeting my need for community, it's meeting my need for knowledge. And then I said, what other ways do you have of meeting those needs? And she came up with about 10 other ways. I said, could you do that even if your husband doesn't let you go? And she said yes, and she was happy. Okay? And one more thing before we stop. I'd like you to look at 335. And 1847. Look at the Sanskrit. What do you notice about the Sanskrit of 335 and 1847? First two lines are the same. First two lines are the same. In 335 and 1847. What's Krishna talking about here? This is talking about behaviors. The trying to change your own nature was talking more about internally. And here he's talking about behaviors. Don't do somebody else's duty. And he gives a positive and a negative. He says on the positive, in the 18th chapter, he gives up the positive. He says, duties that are yours are not affected by sin, right? And after that, he explains that every endeavor has some fault. There's always smoke covering fire. There's fault in every action in this world. There's no action in this world that's intrinsically pure. And what does he tell us in chapter 3? What's his reason?
One's own duty is better than intention.
To follow another path is dangerous. So in the third chapter, he says following another's path is dangerous, and in the 18th chapter, he says following your path is safe. So one's negative and one's positive. And the third chapter, he goes so far, he said, it's better to die doing your duty than to do somebody else's duty. So again, this is something that's repeated. Do you think it's important? So we need to know, how do we know what is our duty? When I first read this in university, I'm like, well, what's my duty anyway? I don't know what my duty is. How do we know what our duty is?
When it feels right.
When it feels right, well, maybe. Maybe. People do all kinds of things that feel good. Yes?
Guru's instructions
and?
Shastra.
Guru's instructions and Shastra. Just like sometimes people who are married say to me, should I have children? I say, well, what does it say in the Shastra? Mm-hmm. First place you look. Shastra. What does it say in the Shastra?
Householders
should have children. That's pretty clear. Yeah? I get that question all the time. Should we have children? Well, look in, what does it say in the Shastra? I don't know. What's the duty of a householder? Is your guru giving you some contrary instruction? Yeah. You take general instructions, then you see I may have some individual instruction that's different. And what service have I been given? What have I been given? Am I the temple president? Am I the GBC? Am I the head pujari? You know, what's my service? What have I been given to do? And we often think we can do other people's service better, especially people who are in charge of us. Because like you were talking about in a marriage, the people who are in charge of us are the gatekeepers for our sense gratification. So when we were young, it was our parents. Then it's our, you know, ashram leader, or it's our husband, or it's our guru, or somebody, or it's the government. And we tend to get very angry at those people, by the way. We do. Even people get angry at their gurus. We tend to see that those people are the blocks of doing what I want to do. And when we're devotees, we think, it's what I want to do for Krishna, maybe. So we often try to take those people's duties, we often try to do their duties, because we think we'll do it that much better. That's very, very, very common. You know, I could do that person's duty. I could do that person's duty. I could do that person's duty. So be very, very careful, right? And this applies also if you're a renunciate. Don't try to do a householder's duty. If you're a householder, don't try to do a renunciate's duty. Do your own duty. Better to try to do your own duty and fail than to do somebody else's duty and succeed. It causes havoc in society, and it will probably cause havoc for you and you probably don't do somebody else's duty really well anyway, because if you would, Krishna would have given it to you as your duty to do, and that's kind of hard to accept sometimes, isn't it? I guess Krishna didn't feel that I could do this duty so well because he didn't give it to me. And every duty has some fault. That means whatever duty that we have, there's going to be some part of that duty that's not so favorable for spiritual life. Okay, we often think, if I could change my material situation, then I'd be a pure devotee. It's just like the materialist thinking, if I could change my situation, then I'd be happy. It's exactly the same. If I could just change my situation, then I'd be, the reason I'm not a pure devotee is because my situation's no good. And of course, the reason my situation is not good is because of this person who's standing between me and Krishna, you know. So, but every situation has its faults. I meet so many householders who say, you know, oh, how can I be Krishna conscious when I have a work at a job and I've got to take care of the kids and I've got to pay the bills? And I said, do you think the traveling sannyasi preachers have a life that completely facilitates their Krishna consciousness? What about all the time they have to spend in airplanes? And airports, is that a nice situation for your Krishna consciousness? What about the fact that they have to deal with everybody's problems? People come and talk to them, and they don't generally talk to them about how enlivened they are in Krishna consciousness. They're usually hearing everybody's modes of passion and ignorance all the time. Right? Sometimes their schedule is very irregular. They're in different time zones all the time. Is all that conducive for your sadhana? So if one person think, oh, going to a job isn't conducive for my sadhana, another person, they're, you know, have to get on the airplane at 6 in the morning, and that's not conducive for their sadhana. You're not going to find, my point is, you're not going to find a situation. Please don't waste your time doing that either. You know, try to get something that works with where you are at the time, according to the shastra, but please don't think if I adjust it this way and that way and this way and that way and this, then I'll be pure devotee. Does that work? Right? People move in the ashram and they still have their mind. They bring their mind with them. Wherever you go, there you are. All right, so we've now gone through the whole Bhagavad Gita. Haribol! 3 days, go through the whole Bhagavad Gita. I hope this was helpful for you.
Yes, thank you.
And we've already gone over time, so I think we need to stop, right? Thank you very, very much. And anything that I said that isn't useful to you, just forget about it. If I said anything wrong, please excuse me. And anything that I said that was useful, please take it on. Okay? Thank you very, very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Wellington Devotees Ki Jai.